Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
And welcome to all of you. Hey, we've got a great interview for you today. But before we get to that, have you ever wondered if there were a way that you could make money on all of the online chatter that millions of investors have on social media? Well, guess what? Your wait's over because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, and it's now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index trades under ticker symbol BUZ. Check it out. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. We have a great interview for you today. I'm going to be talking to Mark Bielek and Paul Murray. They're the principals of Wealth and Advisory Associates, and they're going to be talking to us about saving money on taxes, maybe even getting to zero taxes. How would you like to have the zero tax bracket? Let's say hello to Paul and Mark right now. Mark Bielek and Paul Murray, welcome to the show, guys.
Great to be here.
Well, give me a story about taxes, because everybody thinks about returns. But to your point, and what you guys are famous for is your approach to taxes. Tell me a story maybe where you helped a client avoid some taxes and how it kind of changed the game for them.
The main thing that people don't really focus on is that the IRS is their partner. And we really don't know what our partnership percentage is or what their percentage is until we retire. So we have a lot of success stories that we could tell, because what we effectively do is we help people to position their assets so that when they have to pull money from their retirement accounts, we minimize the amount that the IRS is going to be able to tax. For a million years, we've all been focusing on saving in tax-deferred investment strategies where we get a current tax break. And then later in life, the thinking was, conventional wisdom was, that we're going to be in a lower tax bracket. But once we pay off the mortgage and we lose that deduction, and the kids move out and we lose that deduction, and we're no longer contributing to 401ks and IRAs and we lose that deduction, and we're not charitably contributing money, we're instead contributing our time for which we receive no deduction, oftentimes what happens is people just glide into a higher tax bracket or maintain the same tax bracket. So what we're principally focusing on educating people about, because that's what Mark and I do, we go out and we present at universities and we teach classes about how to properly position your assets so that when you're 70 and a half and the IRS says you have to start taking money out of your retirement accounts, you've minimized their partnership percentage of your savings.
And what's funny that I've seen, to your point, Paul, is that so many people think that this is something I wait until 70 and a half to do, right? I'm not anywhere near 70 and a half, but really you got to think about this stuff as you're saving the money in, so it's in the right place.
Absolutely right.
Well, what we see all the time, Joe, is we've all done it. And Paul and I, when we first got into the business, sang the same song, put as much money into tax deferred as you can. So tax deferred being your 401k, traditional 401k, traditional IRA. You're doing great if you're saving as much as you can into there. But what you're really setting up, as Paul said, is a trap. And that trap is when that money comes out, it's going to be taxed at the I don't know tax rate, right? We don't know what taxes are going to be in the future. Paul and I, and a lot of folks who study like we have, believe that they're going to be significantly higher and perhaps double what they are now. And we just crossed some big milestones in 2018. Our national debt's at $21 trillion. Social Security is now digging into the trust fund. Medicare is scheduled to dig into the trust fund by the end of the year. So these are all things that have to be paid for. And to Paul's point, we have this partnership with the IRS that can change at any given time. Paul and I are 50-50 owners of our business. It's like me having the option to go to Paul at any time saying, hey, now I'm 75% owner and you can't say anything about it. Right? That's an unpopular situation to be in, I think.
That's wild. But to your point, we don't think of it that way, right? That we have this agreement, but we don't get to sign the agreement at the bottom. It gets signed right for us by some people in Washington, whether I like it or not.
That's right. Yeah. And that's a hungry machine in Washington, right? There's a lot to pay for. So to your point about examples, you know, we really could give you so many. When we just do a simple side-by-side comparison that says, if you keep doing what you're doing now and taxes do exactly what we believe are going to do in the future, even if you just creep up into a higher bracket, here's the amount of money you're going to have at age 80. Here's the amount of money you're going to have at age 85. And if you make it beyond that, here's the amount of money here. Sometimes it's millions of dollars difference, not thousands of dollars, but sometimes millions. It's not uncommon that it's very close to a million or more for the average person that we're seeing. That's big money. That's really big money. So the decision is, do you spend it yourself, send it to your kids, or send it to the government? Most people choose to spend it themselves or send it to their kids, right?
Yeah, shocker, right? Yeah. You talk about different asset classes. Is it about then having one or two of the right asset classes, or is it about the amount of money you make, the asset mix based on the amount of money you make, the tax bracket you think you're going to be in later? How does that work?
Well, that's a great question. We got a really big break from the federal government when we received a 7-year break on taxes. Okay. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 basically said for the next 7-8 years until January 1, 2026, we're going to have lower taxes. So what we want to do is we think of them not so much in terms of asset classes, but buckets of money, because you have buckets of money such that, you know, you're going to get different taxation. So you have your taxable bucket, which has your checking accounts, your stocks and bonds outside of retirement accounts, and you get a 1099 for those. And so you're going to pay taxes on those assets. Then you have your retirement bucket, which is known as the tax deferred bucket. And that's your retirement accounts, your IRAs, your 401ks, those accounts, 403bs that you get a tax deduction for. But later in life, you pull it out and you get taxed on them. Our favorite bucket is the tax-free bucket, because those are the Roth IRAs, the Roth 401ks, cash value of life insurance, things that under the Internal Revenue Code are not taxed ever in the future because you already paid tax going into them. And so thinking it along those lines, you can own stocks, bonds, cash, real estate in any of those buckets. It's just that the best and most advantageous bucket is the tax-free bucket.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about that bucket. The first one is, you didn't mention municipal bonds there. And municipal bonds, there's a lot of people screaming at their device. Why didn't you mention that?
Because for it to qualify as truly tax-free, it has to be free of federal tax, state tax, capital gains tax, and does not cause your Social Security to be taxed. So if you buy a municipal bond for $1,000 and that bond value appreciates to $1,500 and you sell it, you pay tax on those capital gains, right? So that eliminates right there. Also, in the calculation of how much of your Social Security is taxed, and it can be from 0% of it taxed to 85% of it taxed, the calculation is called provisional income calculation, and interest from municipal bonds is included in that calculation. So it's interest from municipal bonds, all other income, half of your Social Security is also added into that calculation. So if you're getting $100,000 in municipal income, tax-free municipal income, you are going to pay 85% of your Social Security is going to be taxed.
Which is sad, Mark.
They're not truly tax-free.
Well, no, right. And the sad thing from my perspective is that's the age group that tends to invest in that instrument too, really screwing themselves.
That's right.
Yeah.
Unknowingly.
Yeah. Right, right. Cash value life insurance you brought up. This is an area that's incredibly interesting. Obviously, people are paying premiums. I've brought this up before on other podcasts. It can be a pain in the butt, as you know, a lot of misunderstanding and not right for everybody. But where does cash value life insurance fit in?
Well, it's in the taxable or tax-free bucket, pardon me, because of the fact life insurance itself under the Internal Revenue Code, those benefits are always going to be tax-free. And in fact, most of the modern cash value permanent policies are actually coupling both a death benefit and a long-term care benefit, which is also tax-free. But the buildup of cash within that under the Internal Revenue Code is tax-free. The reason why we put it in the tax-free bucket for purposes of retirement is that when you pull the money out in the forms of a loan against your own cash value that you've built up, because it's a loan, it's not taxable. So the insurance company does some calculations and they may reduce your death benefit, but you can grow your cash tax-free and then pull it out tax-free because what you're essentially doing is you're taking a loan against your own cash value.
But I see people use these wrong all the time. I see insurance agents, to your point, that use these wrong all the time. To do it the way you're talking about, people kind of have to do a mind bend because you really want to stuff the policy full of money. And in most cases, people hear life insurance, and what do they want to do? They want to minimum fund it, and that blows your strategy up.
So when we're talking about cash value life insurance and the tax efficiency of it, we always say properly structured cash value
life insurance.
Because it has to be properly structured on the way going in and the way coming out, too, or the entire thing could blow up. What we talk about is not paying premiums, but shifting assets. So let me explain that for a second. Paul talked about the taxable bucket. So I'll give you a perfect example. We had a new client come in and they just sold a rental property and they said, we want to invest this money, but we want to avoid taxes going forward as much as possible. Well, if they fund, if they shift, in this case, it's $40,000 a year for a 10-year period. They shift from that taxable bucket, $40,000 a year for 10 years, fund the life insurance policy for $400,000. They've properly funded that cash value of life insurance, and it's going to do a couple of things for them. In this case, it's two different policies. One for the mother that gives her $500,000 in coverage, life insurance and long-term care coverage, and some potential withdrawals. But more excitingly, they're taking $15,000 for 10 years for their 33-year-old son, gives him an immediate $1.5 million of life insurance coverage. So he's still single, but at some point he'll get married, have kids, need that. He's paid up after 10 years, never has to put another dime into it if everything works out well. And he can draw out, in our illustration, $48,000 a year, tax-free at age 65.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. So if you think about it as a shift, and that's what we always say, it's a shift of assets. Take it from, you know, we're both part of Ed Slott's Elite Advisor Group. So you familiar with Ed?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love Ed. Yeah. Ed's one of the craziest people I know.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, in a good way, in a good way. Right. But that guy is a dynamo.
Yeah. He's great. His whole staff is great. And Paul and I work with him closely. And we go to study groups two times a year with Ed and the entire group. And he always used the terms. You want to move your assets from forever taxed to never taxed. So once we explain to a client that we're shifting assets, we're not paying a premium, but we're using it as an investment, you know, you could, depending on the insurance structure, it can be a great investment or it can just get you a series of returns. But the end result is tax-free effect of that money that normally you'd be paying tax on forever.
Well, and that's why I didn't want to get hung up on the life insurance, but you and I, all three of us know it's a misunderstood asset class. People don't get it. People use it wrong all the time. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy to know how to use your, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Roth 401k because it's awesome. You should use it, but it's pretty easy to understand. Do you see people screw up anything with the Roth?
Yeah.
Yeah. They,
do you
first
really?
Of all, they underfund it. So the mindset is probably misplaced. We see a lot of folks, very smart folks, highly educated folks that come to our classes or come to see us for a consultation that, first of all, don't realize they have a Roth 401k option. So they always go back and check to see if they do. Most major corporations today do. Some of them we're surprised by that don't. But they also don't know that they can max fund that just like they would their traditional 401k with no income limitations, right? Because you can easily get knocked out of a Roth IRA contribution.
Yeah.
But if you're over 50, $24,500 can go into a Roth 401k. So underfunding is one area.
I would say another area is where people try and create their own Roth by doing non-deductible contributions to IRAs. And they create, in essence, a permanent percentage of their so-called tax-free money as taxable. So funding the Roth is not the same thing as funding a non-deductible IRA and going above and beyond that. So there's a lot of important stuff to think about. But we always counsel everybody, like, if you sincerely believe that you're going to be in the same tax bracket, it's going to be highly unlikely. So think about this tax holiday for the next 7-8 years. Take advantage of it. Fund that Roth. Fund the Roth 401k, the Roth 403bs. Do what you can. Do the Roth conversions. And not, you know, lots of people talk about doing the Roth conversions. They get scared. I've got $700,000. I do it in 1 year. No, you don't have to do that.
Right.
Let's do it over 5 years or 6 years. And so there's a lot of missteps. And as Mark points out all the time, they did away with the do-overs for the Roth conversions. You have to get your conversions right the first time now under the new tax law.
What does that mean, too? But does that also mean, Paul, that it usually the strategy is earlier is always better? Since you don't get a do-over, probably doing it earlier is better?
Earlier in the year or earlier in your lifetime?
Well, either one. But I was thinking earlier in the year was my question.
Once it's done, it can't be reversed under the new tax laws.
Yeah.
It used to be that you had to, what, October 15th of the following year.
Yeah.
That's gone out the window. So you have to get it right immediately at the moment that you're doing it. You know, that's why working with an advisor, you know, an elite advisor with Ed Slott's group or somebody who knows a little bit about this is really important.
Yeah. But do you generally think that earlier then is better because the stock market goes up, what, 70% of the time?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
I would say the opposite, actually. I would say later is better because we don't know what factors are going to come into play during that year. So we know using our custodians and most custodians that a Roth conversion will be guaranteed for the year if it's done prior to 12/1. So we're backing up all of our Roth conversions this year starting October 1st because... Yeah, there could be some growth in the market, but it's a pretty choppy market. There could also be a downturn in the market. And if there's a downturn in the market, we want to take advantage of a lesser amount of IRA to convert. But as Paul said, you can't do a do-over. If there's cash flow issues we have to take into account, I want 10 months of planning behind that before I spend 70, 80, 100. You know, some of our clients are converting $150,000, $200,000 in 1 year as a portion of their IRAs because, you know, you got to move a lot of money over. And I want the ability to hold on to that if we need it.
What about the ever-expanding world of HSAs and people stuffing money into HSAs? That seems like it would fit your tax-free bucket in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I failed to mention that. You know, I like to tell people I fund my daughter's 529 account, and that's going to be tax-free for higher education. I fund my HSA because if it's coming out for qualified medical expenses, I'm going to get tax deduction going in. I'm pulling it out tax-free. And I invest my HSA in the market, actually. I diversify among Vanguard funds, and those options are available. And I know that the Congress and the Senate are starting to think about ways that they can expand the use of HSAs and also Rothify, you know, a lot of the 401ks and things like that. But to your point, HSAs are extremely valuable. And one of the things as planners that we're planning for, I got to credit Mark, you know, Medicare.gov publishes average out-of-pocket expenses for average healthy 65-year-olds. And what's that number this year, Mark?
8350, I believe it is, or 8530.
Per person.
Yep, per individual.
So you're talking about over $16,000 out-of-pocket expenses for the average healthy 65-year-old as published by Medicare.gov. And that number is up way over 10% from last year. 12%. And if you are funding the HSA and getting your tax deductions and growing it in the market or however conservatively as you wish, you're doing yourself a favor to pull that money out tax-free in retirement.
I'm just smiling as you're talking because you guys are throwing numbers around because you use these every day. And I can see you. You're not using notes. Just like, yeah, it's a 12%. Yeah, that's right. I got this little machine in front of me that tells me everything I got to know. I can't sit here and just off the cuff say, yeah, I think it's this number probably. It's not your first rodeo.
Well, Joe, can I just comment on what Paul just said about Medicare? Because that's another thing. And we're always trying to identify things that folks may not be thinking about. Folks are thinking about market volatility and potential loss of assets. They're not considering higher taxes. Hardly anybody's thinking about that. And unless you're 65 or getting really close to that Medicare age, you're not thinking about those out-of-pocket costs. And we see a lot of people that come in and say, we have a financial plan, and they're not accounting for that more than $16,000 a year that the average person spends out of pocket on medical costs. That's a big number.
Sure.
That could be a life-changing number for how long your assets are going to last, too. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the suddenly single issue. Wow. So what does that mean? Two retirees sitting across the table. Highly unlikely that both of them are going to pass at the same time. One of them is going to be single in their lifetime. So what happens? If Paul and I are married, right, I inherit his money. I still have my required minimum distributions out of a greater amount. I probably get a continuation, hopefully, on his pension. I get his Social Security if it's greater than mine. My tax bracket completely changes.
Right.
Now, what may be affordable tax bracket, maybe I'm fortunate to be in a 10% bracket. Likely, under today's tax code, I'm in a 22% bracket. That's a change, too, that you have to plan for. And these are things that most people aren't thinking about. They know that it's likely that husband's going to go before the wife, and that's just actuarially the case. But are they really considering that in the plan? It doesn't happen. Most plans we see are static. They assume a flat tax.
Right.
It's all going to be the same forever. And, you know, working with several hundred retirees in our careers,
never,
hardly ever the case.
Never like that. Right.
And people die. I hate to tell people, but people die and it changes everything.
You should have said spoiler alert before you said that.
Yeah, right.
What are you talking about?
We can go back and edit that.
Right. I want to ask about the new tax law because, Paul, you mentioned this a couple times. New tax law make it easier or harder for people?
Well, it depends on where you are. I'm trying to figure out, as a person who provides services to others, doctors, lawyers, financial advisors, others, there may be a tax increase for us. Most people did get a tax break, and I think that's a great thing. It's just that Mark and I cringe when we think about tax breaks because we as a country can't afford it. Everybody is going to benefit to some extent by hopefully spurring on some economic growth, but the chickens are going to come home to roost. I mean, Medicare is going to run out of money, not going to be able to pay its liabilities, its obligations by 2026. And the Federal Reserve is trying to move us to a more normalized 4 or 5% rate on a 10-year, which means that with $21 trillion in debt, we're going to be servicing $1 trillion in debt payments alone. So, you know, I don't want to be extreme here, but I think it was irresponsible to give everybody a tax cut because we can't afford it unless this amazing experiment, it produces incredible growth and extraordinary revenues that can almost, you know, be unmatched in history. But I don't think that's likely.
But Joe, here's what makes it easier. If you're doing Roth conversions and if you have the right mindset of protecting yourself and trying to adjust the risk or mitigate the risk of higher taxes in the future, it's a gift.
Yeah.
The next 7 years, almost 7.5 years is an absolute gift because the tax code for a married couple, the new 22% bracket starts at $77,000. The top of the 24% bracket ends at $315,000. Think about that. So for an extra 2%, I can transfer, I can convert
a bunch more money. Yeah.
Right?
A bunch more money.
A bunch more. A bunch more. And that automatically goes back per legislation, sunsets December 31st, 2025.
Yeah.
So that's an immediate tax increase. So yes, it's helpful that way. For our planning purposes, it's an absolute gift. And in fact, all the people that we had on a plan, we reevaluated everything and hit the accelerator on a lot of them. Some people, it took them from a very low projected tax rate in the later years after conversions to a zero tax rate. So zero is the best you can get because if taxes double, 2 times 0 is still zero.
Yeah, right.
So that's always our goal for clients. It's not always achievable, but it's exciting when it is.
But I like Paul's answer. The U.S. is like a client coming into him that has a massive credit card problem, right?
Well, yes. Thank you for putting it that way. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And those interest rates rising that is the country's and biggest enemy right now.
Yeah.
And
let's talk about you guys, because talking about a client coming in to see you, you know, a lot of times when people are evaluating a financial advisor, they're looking at one financial advisor versus another, but you guys work together. And my understanding is you work on all of your clients' stuff together. Like you consult with each other on your clients. When did you guys go from single advisors to being a group later in your career? Or did you start off as a team?
We each ran our own independent practices, but we would see each other at industry events and we would start to go to these events together. And, you know, when you're a solo advisor out there, you don't have a monopoly on good ideas and it can get pretty lonely. And as we work together more and more, Mark and I realized, hey, look, we can do great work together because we fundamentally believe that two heads are better than one. And our clients do appreciate that. I mean, they tell us all the time. They know that they can call either one of us, that we're interchangeable in that sense. And so the team approach, I think, draws on two great 18-year experience resources. But Mark is constantly impressing me with the things that he knows that I don't know and vice versa,
Does it become more if I don't say so myself?
Well, we won't let him answer that just in case he gives me the wrong answer.
But does it become more expensive for your clients? Because I think about like a lawyer with billable hours. I've got two of you in the room instead of one. I think, yeah, I like two heads, but I don't like the much, much higher fee.
Now, that's a really good question. The answer is no. You know, we charge the industry standards. It's based on the assets under management. We've gotten away from flat fee only planning or hourly billing. Paul and I used to both work heavily in the divorce arena. So financial planning and divorce cases where we would charge hourly on cases. It's not fun.
Right.
Keeping track of your hourly rate. And we found that for folks that would come on to us and just say, listen, we'll pay you a fee of $5,000, $10,000, map out the plan for us. Often the implementation isn't there. So what I mean by that is I'm going to take this and do it myself, or I've got, you know, a stockbroker at Merrill Lynch I've been working with for a number of years, and I'm going to take it to him or her, and have him implement it, and then it just doesn't get done. Or it doesn't get done properly, which is worse. So now we have a pretty staunch standard that says we need to have everything in-house, and then we charge a percentage based on the assets, just like gotcha. Everybody else.
Sure.
And it's right in line with what the market is.
How do people find you guys?
Well, we have a terrific website, planwithadvice.com. They can find us on Facebook, Wealth and Advisory Associates. It's the name of our firm. And also LinkedIn as well. If you live in the Philadelphia metropolitan area, we have two locations, one in Lower Bucks County, Newtown, and we have one in Middle Bucks County in Chalfont. And, well, more opportunities to speak to people like you, hopefully in the future as well. So.
Awesome. And you know what? If you're driving down the road to work or home, or you're walking the dog or whatever, we've got you covered. We've got the links to Paul and Mark on our show notes page at moneytreeinvesting.com. Guys, thanks for hanging out with us a few minutes. I really appreciate you guys actually make this idea of talking taxes fun, which is crazy.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
We love it. Thank you very much, Joe.
Coming up next, I'm going to talk to my friends, Linda and Doug, about today's interview. But before we do that, if you wondered if there were a way for you to cash in on all those people talking about stocks and investing online, well, guess what? Your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index is licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives people like you and I a basket of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. People talk positively, that's what they buy. No surveys, no guessing. Instead, Buzz targets the most mentioned large-cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz, and each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish score, those each month are included in the index. So if you want to know more about how it works, head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. By the way, congratulations to Jamie Wise and the team at Buzz Index for some more milestones recently that they've reached with the Buzz Index. I own the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you, but I think I need to disclose that. And also, I'm going to disclose to you who the heck is on our panel today. We're going to start out in the desert where Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart, not Be Wealthy or Smart, Linda. It's Be Wealthy and Smart.
That's right. You got to be both.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
I'm better because I've had a cup and a half of coffee and I'm talking to you.
So. And I'm better because I'm back now, and I was gone last week, took a little trip, got out of the heat in the desert, and happy to be back with you guys. But now we're missing Miranda.
I think it's funny, when I was in Michigan, I always wanted to take vacations like in January and February to get out of the snow. And now in Texas, I'm hoping in July to go someplace.
Get out of the heat.
Yeah. I know, it's the same thing. Head north. Mm-hmm. Not north, but way, way east or west, I suppose, halfway around the globe from us, but next to us in our hearts, the one and only Doug Goldstein.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the vacation I took last week in this gorgeous 5-star hotel here in downtown Jerusalem. My wife and I, on the way to work, we drove by as they were building it, and we said, you know, we have to go there when they finish. And they finished. It is like fantastic. So anyone who's looking for a fantastic hotel in Jerusalem, give me a call.
I thought by 5-star hotel, that was a euphemism. Like Cheryl and I, you know, we're between houses because our house sold too fast. So we're in a 3-room apartment over Uncle Jack's garage. And I'm not kidding about that. And we call that a 5-star hotel. I thought that's what you were talking about.
This is like where they give you bathrobes and slippers. And when you walk into the room, there's gentle music playing and your name is on the screen. Welcome, Mr. and Mrs. Goldstein. Yeah, I love that. It was a lot of fun.
Nice. Nice staycation.
Yeah, yeah.
That is awesome. I stayed in a hotel. Well, I won't get into that. I stayed at a Holiday Inn once. let's talk about that. Can you, Doug, live that type of lifestyle and pay no tax?
Well, there are those people, you know, who live on boats and they live more than 12 miles offshore any country, and somehow they've managed to avoid taxes, except probably if they're American, because, you know, America is one of the, I think, only 2 countries in the world that charges you tax on worldwide income. So most every country, if you don't live there anymore, you don't have to pay tax anymore. But Americans, no matter where they go, there's the tax man right with them.
Linda, when it comes to the tax man and it comes to your investments, do you find yourself trying to minimize taxes?
I do. I think it's an important part of your financial strategy to try to minimize taxes because, you know, I forget who it was, but there was a great quote that said, you're only obligated to pay as much tax as you are, you know, you legally must pay and not a penny more. And so we have all these great deductions. We have a huge complicated tax code that just got revised, but in the past, it's been interesting because you can find different deductions you didn't know about and things like that. I have a CPA that I use and I've used for years. I think she is worth her weight in gold. I will pay her any amount just to handle all of that for me because she's saved me a lot of money in my taxes. She does things for me. And I think it's one of the best ways I spend money all year. I consider it an investment. It is important, though, to try to reduce your taxes, I believe.
You know, Paul and Mark talk a lot about tax planning with your investments, though. Does your CPA also help you with that? Look at your investment portfolio and go, here's a tax strategy around those, like they talked about the Roth 401k, permanent life insurance, those kind of things?
She does. She will, you know, do any kind of cash flow analysis, tax analysis of the future, that kind of thing. But my portfolio is fairly simple, so I don't need a lot of kind of complicated strategies and planning and that kind of thing. So I think people need to be aware, like our guests said, that there are some great strategies to use that people need to make sure they're using those and avoiding taxes where they can, thinking about future taxes, because that really is an issue, not knowing what the tax brackets are going to be in the future. And if we can avoid tax at some point in our life when we don't have that income stream coming in from a job, that's a great thing for people to really be conscious of and be planning for.
Yeah, Doug, we spent a lot of time with Mark and Paul talking about permanent life insurance because when they brought that up, I thought, man, we better spend some time there because this could get ugly. I can imagine people on their morning commute yelling at their device because life insurance gets such a bad rap. What do you think about permanent life insurance as a tax savings vehicle?
So I think in the past, we have spent a lot of time talking on the show about the pros and cons of insurance policies. And overall, I think I've been pretty negative about it because I think that the costs involved in these sort of policies certainly don't justify all of the other, you know, the major disadvantages. But I'm actually glad that we're going to discuss that a little bit because I think that one of the things that a lot of, you know, clients see or they see advertisements or they meet with an insurance guy and, you know, he shows some chart. He says, well, look, you know, not only will you have the insurance coverage, but that's just so secondary because look how the benefit of compound interest without paying taxes is really so good for you. And I think that people get swept away by that. Have you, I mean, am I the only person who's seen people get swept away by that and really it's not such a good deal?
No, I totally agree, which is why I wanted them to define it because I do think it's a great strategy, but for far fewer people than actually I see with the policies.
Yeah, I just sort of wonder why. Listen, for a lot of people, maybe it's a good idea when there is some structure in place that forces them to do certain types of investing and saving that they wouldn't otherwise do. And it does perhaps have some tax advantages, even though when you eventually take the money out, the tax actually may be higher than if you had just paid capital gains tax. But if people are going to do that, especially the types of people, frankly, who listen to a show like ours, don't you think that they're going to be a little more capable of organizing their own finances so that they can have savings on the one hand and an emergency fund on the other hand and do a Roth IRA like you spoke about with them and other long-term investments that can be made more tax efficient by doing things like tax loss harvesting or simply paying the capital gains tax, which is usually lower on long-term capital gains?
It's interesting if you actually do the math on some of these policies, and I don't want to keep getting into this too much. It can actually save you a lot of money, but man, is that some complex math. I mean, which is why it applies to so few people. But to get off the life insurance, I'm going to stop kicking that dead horse, which is a horrible phrase, by the way. But Linda, when it comes to the Roth, I mean, it seems like Paul and Mark are all about and they really favor these strategies where you're going to get zero tax down the road. You're going to pay the tax today, but you're never going to pay tax again. Do you think that could come back to bite people?
Well, who knows what the future holds? I mean, it's very difficult to predict that. And certainly with the government, things have changed and will continue to change. But I think the important thing is all we can do is plan for what is provided for today. And today we know what the tax law is and we know how to avoid taxes in the future. And we just have to run with that and do the best that we can. You know, the Roth was a really significant change when that happened because it really was to benefit people in retirement to reduce their taxes and to help with that. And I think that is something that should be taken advantage of. I'm not sure how the general public is very educated about that or very clear. I'd love to see some sort of survey tell us how many people understand the difference between a traditional or a Roth IRA. I think it's probably less than we would imagine. And that's kind of scary because it's a tremendous benefit that people could actually, you know, really use and would put money in their pocket.
Yeah, but do you think it's always a benefit? I mean, let's just sort of touch on this because I think certainly when we get together and talk about Roth IRAs, we're usually pretty optimistic about it. But, you know, don't forget that unlike a traditional IRA, where you get a tax deduction with the money that you put in, on a Roth IRA, you don't. In other words, this is after-tax money, so you don't get to put in as much. Not only that, you're not even actually able to put in that much amount, you know, that much money. So for people who want to be big-time savers, the Roth IRA is nice for a piece of the pie, but you know, it's not necessarily going to give you a huge amount of savings.
So you're not a Roth first advisor.
I love the Roth. Love the Roth. Listen, it's a fine idea, but don't forget it's complicated. It's not for everyone. You know, there are all sorts of conditions based on how much money you earn. So it's not like every person who's listening to us today can go out and put in the maximum amount to a Roth IRA. I mean, listen, if I got to choose the policies, I would certainly like the idea of Roth IRAs, but I would make it with far fewer restrictions because it's those restrictions that stop people from really being able to get as huge a benefit as they might otherwise do. And don't forget, you know, if you tell someone, make sure you fund your Roth IRA and that'll protect you in your retirement, people like that may think, oh, good, I've done it. And then they're done. And it's nowhere near enough because of the relatively small amount you can put in compared to what you really need to save.
Right. Unless you got a Roth 401k, where then you can stuff a lot more money in there.
Yeah. Or a really rich spouse.
That's perfect.
Well, and people are doing the backdoor strategies right, too, which, you know, can help. But I think one of the least talked about things that is so important is the fact that you don't have to start taking money at age 70 and a half in your Roth IRA. And since people are living longer, I mean, maybe it's just on my mind because my mother lived into her 90s, but it's something that as we have more longevity, people are worried about running out of money and it's a real issue. And so forcing them to take money at 70 and a half, I think being able to avoid that by having a Roth is a very important point of a Roth. And I think that sometimes just gets overlooked or not talked about, not thought about. Maybe it's just because women outlive men in general. And so we're a little bit more concerned about that. But most men die married and most women die single. So it is a real issue that women are going to have to deal with these things on their own. And they are probably going to live longer. So it's just something, you know, to be aware of in your planning.
I think that in general, Linda, and I'm glad you brought this point up. I think in general, the media talks a lot about how to put money in, which is why I like talking to Mark and Paul, because their whole bent's the opposite, right? It's about how you take money out. And I think that's the thing, is that we're so interested in trying to get people to start saving money because nobody does that, that talking to people about the other end of the stick and age 70 and a half rules and things like that just completely are overlooked. But I think also when it comes to longevity, you know, there's some exciting things going on now with annuities as well, finally, because maybe, I don't know, Linda, is the spotlight maybe starting to turn that way?
Well, it could be. I mean, annuities could really provide, I should say, they provide a unique benefit in that they can pay you for as long as you live, however long your life is. The problem that we had in the past with annuities is that when inflation ran high, you were on a fixed payment. And so as inflation grew, that payment had less and less purchasing power. You got the same amount for, you know, the rest of your life. And think about that, never getting a raise for inflation.
Well, aren't there annuities that actually provide for that now?
There are some, yes, that do that. But the reality is that annuities have that one flaw where, in general, that's an issue. So I think they can be helpful. I think it's a multi-tiered approach that is important. Just like we diversify with our investments, I think we have to think about diversifying with some of our retirement income vehicles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think with an annuity, don't forget that when you get money out of an annuity, just to go back to what we were saying earlier about the taxation, this is not taxed like a capital gain, which is at a low rate. This is taxed as income. And that can definitely, you know, surprise you. Don't think just because taxes may have gone down a little bit now, which, you know, great, But by the time you retire, who knows what how much money the government is going to need. And, you know, to fund all those programs, they're going to have to, you know, keep funding them with someone else's money until people don't have any more money. And they'll just raise taxes when that becomes necessary. And if that coincides with your retirement, with your annuitizing, wow, that could really be a shocker.
I want to ask you two, as seasoned investors, what tax strategy or maybe tax approach do you find is often overlooked that you really would like to shine a light on? Linda, do you have one that you can think of?
You know, honestly, if I had to say, I would say the Roth. I would say the Roth because, again, I don't think people are all that familiar with it. I mean, our listeners are because they're into money and more savvy about money. But I think the general public, I'd really like to know what it is that, you know, how many of them know about a Roth? Because when you look at even savings rates, I mean, the average American saves under 3%. A minimum should be 10%. A good savings rate should be 20%, in my opinion. You really should shoot for that. And then get your investing started. And that's so important, is to get to that compounding rate. But a lot of us don't take advantage of the opportunity that the tax law provides to do that on a tax-deferred or tax-free basis, which is even going to make that stronger and, you know, more to your benefit and build more wealth for you. So I think it is overlooked.
Doug, how about you?
So I'm going to talk to people who live outside the United States because there is a real tax problem that a lot of them have. A lot of Americans retire all over the world, or they move, you know, to other countries for any of a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it's often cheaper to live outside the United States, but they still either have U.S. investments or they go overseas and they say, oh, you know, listen, let me invest now that I'm here. So they go into their local bank or brokerage firm. Let's say they live in Israel, and the banker says, oh, you know, you could buy this mutual fund, you know, this Israeli mutual fund that invests in global stocks or something. So the client goes ahead and buys it. And what he doesn't realize is that what you and I think is a totally normal investment, a mutual fund, if it's not a U.S. mutual fund, then the IRS would consider that an offshore mutual fund. Also, the fancy name is called a PFIC, a passive foreign investment corporation. And this, it's not illegal for an American to buy it, but boy, is it a bad idea, because it has awful, awful tax consequences. Basically, it's assumed by the IRS, or presumed by the IRS, that every year you sell it and then you buy it back. So any gains that you have are taxable on a yearly basis. There's no such thing as long-term capital gains. And that's just the beginning of it. Ask any accountant who's a specialist in cross-border taxation, and he or she will tell you that this is like the worst thing that an American can do. And yet, I have to tell you, as someone who deals with Americans overseas all the time, I try to help them to invest in the United States because that's a normal thing. But a lot of times they go, no, you know, I'm in Israel, or I live wherever I live. I want to do it here. And until I explain to them that normal investments that they did in America, like ETFs and mutual funds, if they're done in the foreign country where they live, it ties them up in a terrible, terrible tax situation.
What a mess. You can see a lot of people probably inadvertently stepping in it hard.
Stepping in it hard. Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite is, often I see people with the right assets to meet the goal, but they have them in the wrong place. Let me explain. They'll have a bunch of dividend payers that they don't need long term. They're not collecting the dividends. They're just reinvesting them. They have those outside of their tax shelter in a regular brokerage account. And then inside their tax shelter, like to Linda's point, maybe a Roth IRA, they'll have these very tax efficient investments. And we would usually look at what the cost would be to just swap that approach and make the investments that are outside of the tax shelter more efficient, and then all the inefficient assets from a tax perspective, put those inside of tax shelters. I don't see enough people pay attention to that.
I think that's a big issue. Just to add on to that, also for people who move overseas, the one thing you had mentioned, Joe, in the interview is municipal bonds, which everyone, or many, many people think, oh, that's great, I never have to pay taxes. Yeah, but if you live overseas, the whole concept of a municipal bond doesn't apply to the foreign country where you live. And in fact, the interest and or gains or whatever you get from it, or if it's a fund, will probably be taxable just like any other bond. So traditionally, we say that municipal bonds usually pay a lower interest rate than parallel corporate bonds. But the reason an American in a high tax bracket would buy it is because he would say, oh, well, because I don't have to pay tax, my net at the end of the day is higher. But if you have to pay tax on that bond, then your net is going to be lower.
Wow. Let's find out what's going on where all of you guys live. Linda, what are you doing over there at Be Wealthy and Smart?
At Be Wealthy and Smart, recently I did a podcast about how millennials can become millionaires. And it's not just for millennials, though, because wealth building habits apply to all people. And so no matter what your age, check it out at Be Wealthy and Smart.
Awesome. And Doug, how about you?
Well, I've been browsing the web a little bit looking for a great book to read on investing. And I came across one that is not yet out, but it's coming out next month by Linda P. Jones, our very own. And then I said, wait a second. I got a book coming out next month too. Her book is well, I'll let her tell us about it soon. But I'm actually coming out with a book also called The Inheritance Book, which is specifically designed for people who live outside the United States who are getting an inheritance. And hopefully that'll be up in September as well.
Awesome. And at Money in the Morning, one of my two podcasts, well, one of my three podcasts, if I include one two here with you guys, I suppose I should include this, shouldn't I? But at Money in the Morning, we recently talked about Cardi B paid $500,000 cash for a Lamborghini. And what the heck does that have to do with your money? Well, you'll have to listen and find out. So that's at Money in the Morning. Hey, thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to everyone who's left us a review of this show. And you know what, Doug and Linda, I'm not going to get this right because I never have to do this part of the show.
I know.
So
we all rely on Miranda.
Nobody cares about your money as much as you do. So invest in your life. I do remember that. How's that?
There you go.
It was great. You did well, Joe, and we really appreciate everyone listening.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.